Well, hello and welcome back to another Tech Doctor podcast. How are you today, Allison?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, thank you. I'm excited today because we have a veteran podcaster with us. She's done some 350 of them over the years, as well as written a number of books and been heavily involved in the technology industry, access technology, and mainstream technology for the last quarter of a century. Her name is Shelley Brisbane, and Shelley, welcome to the Tech Doctor podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Robert. It's great to be here.
If you will, tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Well, I've been a journalist in the technology world for, God, that quarter of a century. That does sound a long time, doesn't it? I have a degree in journalism, and then I quickly spun that into a career in writing about technology. And I'm low vision, and one of the real reasons I got into technology was the fact that I was low vision, and I got a Mac Plus, having just come out of journalism school and wanting to do publication production and layout and writing and all that kind of stuff. And I realized back in those days, in the mid-80s, desktop publishing was just starting, and the way people used to actually put together publications was that they laid them out on light tables and had to use X-Acto knives and lay things out straight. And I knew that as a low vision person that was going to be difficult for me, but that was also going to hamper my career. And so when desktop publishing came along, I quickly borrowed some money from my mom, got a Mac Plus, and started teaching myself how to use PageMaker. And from that, I spun out into a career writing about technology because I was just so curious about how everything worked. I didn't have a tech background at all. I was a writer in history and English and all those liberal arts things in school. But I was fascinated by technology, and I also wanted to conquer it. I never wanted to be in a position where I didn't know how something worked.
I guess given that that was the mid-80s, really it was pretty much back then a self-teaching kind of process. There weren't teachers standing in line waiting to teach you those things.
No, not at all. And I think there were, you could get desktop publishing courses, which basically amounted to here's how PageMaker works. And it would also be the sort of thing. I mean, I had the background in journalism, so the actual content that I was that far ahead in terms of, I didn't have to be taught what a font was or how to measure column inches or anything. But what I really did teach myself was the troubleshooting side of keeping a computer running and figuring out what to do when it crashed and, you know, how to fix hardware and software. So the short version is I eventually ended up with my dream job, which was working as an editor at Mac User Magazine. And this, you know, took me a few years to get to that point, but I had been a freelance writer. I wrote product reviews and that sort of thing. Went to Mac User, learned an incredible amount, spent 5 years in California. And since then, I've been, that was in the 90s, I've been writing technology books. I've written about 12 books. I've written hundreds and hundreds of magazine articles. And then at some point in the mid-2000s, I got interested in podcasting. And this is like the super short version, but I've been working in editorial positions, usually in technology fields, for those past 25 years. And then I've also tried to branch out a little bit and write about spirits and cocktails, which is an interest of mine. I've done a little blogging on that subject. And so I've managed to, generally speaking, earn a living telling people how to use technology, and it's been a lot of fun.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's exciting because it sounds like in many ways you created this career yourself, just starting from your interest in the Mac and wanting to do desktop publishing, and you have pulled all these various aspects of it together into a fairly cohesive and very successful career. And that's kind of exciting when someone can do that.
You know, it's funny because it always, when you explain it, it sounds like, wow, I had this master plan and I made it work and look at me. But over the course of, you know, things come together, and there's serendipitous moments, and then there are people out there who help you. I mean, one, you know, little things happen. Like I remember somebody I work with at Mac User said to me, you know, what are you going to do after all this is done, because the magazine was closing down. And I said, you know, one of my goals has always been to write a book. I want to write a book before I'm 40. And I was probably in my early 30s at that point. And she said, well, I know a book agent. And she introduced me to her. And my agent helped me figure out how to write a book proposal and how to move on to that facet of my career. So it wasn't as if I just, single-mindedly pursued a specific thing. It was just I had I had help and I told the right people at the right time.
What kind of books did you write?
I wrote several books about the Adobe Go Live web development environment. I co-wrote a couple of the Mac OS X for Dummies books and also a book called Macintosh Answers. So a lot of how-to on the Mac, on wireless networking, and on web development.
And Shelley, is your visual acuity such that you're able to use the screen on the Mac, or how much vision do you actually have?
I do use a screen. I'm amazed to recall that I did actually use the 9-inch Mac Plus screen to lay out publications back in the day, which to me is kind of amazing because it was teeny tiny.
Yeah.
And in those days, they didn't have VoiceOver. There wasn't even really high contrast or magnification software back in the beginning. I mean, you could zoom in an application, but I have usable vision for that purpose. And you know, back in those days, I should say that there wasn't really super good accessibility software for either the PC or the Mac platform. But by the time I started using what rudimentary tools there were, the Mac was kind of ahead of Windows. It was before all the big the screen readers were out and Zoom Text and all that kind of stuff. And so I used a thing called Close View, which Apple shipped with Mac OS that did reverse video and magnification. Mostly I use reverse video. That's my number one enhancement or accessibility thing that I use because I want high contrast and I want to reduce the amount of light that's in the background of the screen. And then I'll zoom in when I need to. And that's, you know, now that stuff is far better in OS X, OS X than it ever was back in the day. I used to carry around a floppy drive with a copy of Close View on it so that if I was at a Mac other than my own, I could install it, which involves sticking the disk in, copying the software over to the system folder, restarting the Mac, and then turning it on when you got there. And I literally had a floppy in my back pocket all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And it is true that in those days, there was a bit more available for someone with low vision than there was for a totally blind person. We had Outspoken, which was the one
right.
screen reader really for the Mac, but it quickly got trumped for most of us by all the DOS and Windows screen readers
yep.
that came along for the PC. And so I started out actually with the Apple II. We had pretty good talking software on the Apple II.
Yeah.
But when the Mac came along, we kind of got left behind for about 20 years, and then VoiceOver came along in, I guess, 2005. So for you, though, it sounds like the Mac has pretty much been usable since the mid-80s.
It has been. I mean, there have been challenges, and probably those Mac Plus days were the biggest challenge simply because there was so little screen real estate. And I remember there was a point when the SE30 came out, and the company I was working at the time bought a Radius 15-inch display that you could connect to the SE30. And one guy had one in the editorial department because he was doing a lot of layout. And I remember sitting in front of this 15-inch screen and just never wanting to leave because it was the greatest thing ever. It was enormous.
Oh, yeah.
15-inch portrait display. And so I the thing is, I didn't know what I didn't have back before Close View. And so my real issue, there have always been these points, inflection points where there becomes an issue. For example, when external monitors became available for the Mac, when you started getting away from the compact Mac platform, a lot of those monitors were really bright. Sony particularly made these Trinitron monitors that were really great, except that they were incredibly bright. So the first thing I would have to do is turn them down, or if I had a choice, because I was working at Mac User in those days, I would say, please don't give me a Sony Trinitron, because I know those are super bright. And that was great for everybody else, because they wanted those monitors. And so you learn little things like that, and I was in the kind of environment where I could make my needs known, and I was a pretty good advocate for myself, because I understood what I needed far better than the people around me, and I also could articulate it because I had the tech background, and that's something a lot of people don't necessarily have.
Have you always been a low-vision person?
Yes.
So having grown up with that, I guess in some ways that perhaps helped you learn to become a good advocate for yourself.
Yeah, I switched from a school for the blind to public school in junior high, which is both the best and worst time to do that, because I had enough presence of mind and I had enough positive experiences as a kid that I could I knew how to advocate for myself, and I was a pretty good talker. But at the same time, junior high is when you're a pretty vulnerable person, and so it was kind of a trial by fire. You know, you're a 12-year-old kid, and you're trying to figure out how to tell. I mean, this isn't really about technology, but you're trying to tell a teacher, this is what I need, this is what I don't need. If you can do this thing for me, I can succeed in your class. First of all, knowing what those things are, and second of all, being able to articulate it. And I learned that at that age through a lot of trial and error and tears and heartache and stuff like that. And so by the time I got into the professional world, I was a pro.
Right, you knew what you wanted and needed that. Yeah.
Right.
It almost seems like in some ways that hard time back then as a junior high person really prepared you for a lot of the things that you would face later on, gave you the tools to figure out what you needed and to advocate for them. And that's kind of an interesting irony there, isn't it?
It did. And I also think that because I ended up in the technology world, because some of the solutions to problems were pieces of equipment, it made it possible for me to provide to know concretely what would help. So if I had been, I don't know, I can't think offhand of an example, but if I had been in another career where the solutions would have been more about workarounds to the way of doing something rather than here's a piece of equipment that I can use or here's a piece of software that I can use, it might have been a different challenge. I don't know. So I could give a pretty good presentation of somebody who understood the technology, and I would come in and I'd say, hey, well, this is, I know enough about the Mac to know that this tool will be helpful to me. And I could show them, I could give them a concrete example, and I could say, you know, here, if you buy this for me or if you help me get it, I did some of that, not a great deal. And sometimes a lot of it was underground, a lot of it was my own, you know, downloading stuff rather than going and saying, will you buy this piece of equipment for me? So that's the other thing. I mean, a lot of people have the experience of the bureaucracy around buying accessible equipment, especially since the ADA was passed. A lot of this was pre-ADA. Irony is, I got my job Mac user the year the ADA was passed. It came into law the day I flew to California for my job interview, which actually gave me an incredible amount of confidence. I didn't know what it would literally mean to me, but it was just sort of like this great experience of being on this plane going, well, maybe this will be a good backup for me. Maybe this will help me when I get out there. And I think it helped me psychologically more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Was being low vision an issue working at Mac User Magazine?
I think sometimes it was because I had to prove myself. I think there are people who didn't really know what to expect. And what I did was I became one of the more technical editors. What I learned when I got into technology journalism was that there are people who are word people and there are people who are technical people. And a lot of times that overlaps, but a lot of times there's kind of, you're in one or the other camp.
Yeah.
And I kind of leaned into the tech camp, which, and this is an interesting issue in terms of being female, that was more men who were in technology journalism did that. Women tended to opt toward being a copy editor, toward being very fastidious about the words and the grammar and everything. And I could do that. I, you know, had a background in English and all that stuff. But what I really did to differentiate myself, and I think sort of make the low vision less of an issue, was just to lean in. And so my very first assignment at Mac User was to write a giant feature about hardware accelerators, which was this incredibly technical thing that had lots of charts. And I loved it, but I also realized that if I could make a success of something that was fairly challenging and fairly technical, that people's sort of uninformed thoughts about my low vision would be a little less of an issue because I could wave this 12-page article in front of them and I could say, hey, look, you know, I'm in the same environment you are and I'm succeeding. Now, I would say, I'm colorblind as well, and so there would be times when we would have graphics and illustrations and I had to learn to say, which was not natural for me, you know, I'm colorblind. I'm probably not the best judge of whether this is a good graphic. And I made friends with the art director, and I would be really honest with her. And I would say, I'm going to need not only you to create something that I sign off on, but I'm really going to need your guidance. I'm going to rely on you. And it was really hard to sort of, the hardest part for me was always to figure out what my limitations were and to explain them and to say, I'm limited in this way, but not in this way. So here's where I'm going to need your assistance, but that has to come along with, here is the way I'm completely competent in this other area.
And I think that's something that's common to all of us as blind and low vision people. That's the line we walk, you know?
I suspect it's even more complicated for you, though, in a way. I'm totally blind, so when someone looks at me, they know that. But with you, they probably don't necessarily know, I would guess, that you're low vision. And so it's the onus is always on you, I would assume, to explain it to everyone.
Yeah, and even if people have had contact with low vision folks, every low vision person is different. And I've said that many times, you know, blind is pretty self-explanatory. If you want to know what blind is, close your eyes.
Yeah.
And do that for as long as you wish to and whatever task that you want to simulate. But if you're low vision, my low vision is different. I mean, I spent 7 years at the Texas School for the Blind before I did switch to public school, and I knew a lot of low vision people, some who had more vision than I, some less. And it's actually interesting. I was thinking about this the other day. You get, even in that environment, which is supportive and where everybody's got some vision issue, whether it's low vision or total blindness, you know who's got what vision because you've had that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know that, I mean, I knew that my best friend was better with large print than I was. She could see better. She was not as sensitive to light as I was. I mean, you knew the sort of subtleties of that. But you go out into the wider world and people reasonably, you know, it's reasonable. They don't understand what the nuances of that low vision is. And so when I have to do what I was talking about before and go out of my comfort zone and say, here's my limitation, I try to be as specific as I possibly can. If I'm trying to decide what kind of illustration to put in a magazine article, I'm not going to get in a conversation with you about whether I can drive a car or navigate safely across a large highway.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's a sort of a large bore example, but you know what I mean. It's like you want to be specific to the task at hand so as not to confuse people.
Yeah, of course, and I'm sure that has become something that you've gotten good at over the years, because otherwise you probably wouldn't get what you needed from people. You wouldn't get the help that you needed or get the specifics that you needed to accomplish the task.
Yeah, and I'm not always as good at it as I would like to be, and there are issues, and it's a funny thing, and I've always said that that people, kids who grow up low vision, during that time when you're in school, there's a way in whatever your academic experience, whether you're in a mainstream environment or whether you're in a school for the blind or something like that, kids kind of have it easier because there is a lot more focus on how can we get this person successfully through an educational experience. But once you get out on your own, the thing they don't teach you in school is how to navigate your own low vision to other people and how to explain it and even how to understand it yourself, because you might want to do something desperately. You might have to figure out a workaround, and you might not know what that workaround is.
Well, yeah, if you go to work for Mac User Magazine, or you decide to write some books, or you do magazine articles that are going to be distributed to the general public, you're definitely flying on your own at that point. You you have to invent the way to make it happen, it sounds like.
Yeah, which is why it's sometimes hard to translate to other people. I mean, I've thought about changing careers at various times, not because I don't love to write, because I do, but I thought about getting into a more technical field. I'm not a programmer, but I would certainly, you know, I have the temperament and the sort of logical mind for it, but I've never learned how to do it. So I thought, well, what would the issues and challenges be if I wanted to do that? Or I have an interest in the beverage industry, and I thought to myself, I don't want to become a bartender necessarily, but what if I wanted to be a beverage consultant? Or what if I wanted to write about cocktails and spirits, and that would require a lot of travel and a lot of experience, work in the hospitality industry where you're dealing with people in social situations and you need to recognize them, which I have issues with. You know, what would my workarounds be? And sometimes
right.
you don't know until you jump in. And there's
yeah.
a point in your life when, you know, anybody who would be making a mid-career change or an adjustment like that, you have to deal with fear of failure or fear of rejection or just fear of, I don't want to do anything I'm not going to be good at. And it's hard to know how much risk to take. I'm sort of a risk-averse person, which doesn't sort of sound that way from the career I've had, but in a way, I mean, I always knew I could write. Like, whatever issues there were visually, I always knew I could sit down at a keyboard and write. There was never going to be a problem. And as a freelancer, I'm in my house. I can write a book I don't have to worry about what other people think of me or whether the fact that I'm an inch or two away from the screen is freaking somebody out. Or, I mean, I can take longer if I need to. I don't necessarily, but I, you know, I'm in complete control of my surroundings and my environment, which is much easier than in a workplace environment.
Mm-hmm. You are a person who is willing, if you have to get on a plane and fly to California and take a job at a magazine, or you're also willing to work from home and enjoy the safety and comfort of that. And it's only part of being a human being to say, you know, I have these fears and these issues with this, but it sounds like those fears, you have not allowed them to stop you from doing these things. And that's kind of what makes it interesting and exciting.
Yeah, and as I say, sometimes more than others. I mean, there have been times in my life when I've really felt like I wanted to be doing something. I wanted to be a little more, taking more risks or being more brave than I actually was because I got too comfortable working here at home. And yeah. I thought to myself, well, you know, what I need to do is be out in an environment where I'm challenged, not just to make me a better person in the abstract, but actually because your skills kind of atrophy. You're dealing with people both socially and just in terms of the politics of working in an office environment, and those have good and bad. It's good and bad, but you do tend to atrophy if you're in one place rather than the other. Like if you're always in an office, maybe your ability to work independently would be harmed. I don't know because I've worked so much freelance. But if I'm working here by myself, if you came to me tomorrow and said, Shelley, I want you to come to my Fortune 500 company and work, there would be a period of adjustment for me. And also my temperament. I'm kind of cranky and I like to work by myself and I don't like office politics. And that's the other thing. There's some knowing yourself about it. Because I talked to some people about working at Dell, which was going to have its own challenges from a transportation point of view, because they're a good ways away from me and there's not public transit. But I also had to think about, is my temperament such and my personality such that I'm going to survive and thrive in an environment like that, where there's also going to be a learning curve? I've certainly used Windows machines a lot, but on a daily basis, I'm a Mac geek. And so if I'm going to go into an environment like that and work on, you know, writing about enterprise computing and stuff like that, there's going to be some learning. There's going to be some issues of figuring out the interpersonal stuff plus the transportation stuff. You know, it's all I guess what I would say that would be useful to other people is just think about all that stuff before you plunge so that you can be more likely to be successful and understand what your issues are going to be. And for me, being sort of a cranky curmudgeon and liking to work at home is part of that.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, I mean, I've enjoyed it. And I think I benefited from going back and forth, which I haven't done in quite some time. But for a few years, I did go back and forth a little bit. I had a few jobs that I then, in fact, in two cases, I quit jobs because I got book contracts. And so I went back home and was happy doing that. And I've found, though, that when you work by yourself, you do need to force yourself to go out, whether it's working in a coffee shop, which I do a lot, or whether it's getting involved in your community in some way, or podcasting, that mm-hmm. finding a way to interact with you. I mean, I've made some great friends online, and it's not just sitting around on Facebook and hitting the like button. I really have met, and especially through podcasting, I've met some incredible people. And keeping those friendships alive and keeping in touch kind of helps me stay sane when I'm sitting here in the same room doing my work all day.
Yeah, it's a good point. It does, in a way, even if it's virtually, get you out there. Let's fast forward to now. What kind of access technology do you use now on the current Macs to do your work?
Well, I'm using the built-in inverted colors reverse video feature on the Mac, and then I will sometimes use Zoom in applications if I'm doing particularly close work, usually in a graphics application or something like that. But I don't use VoiceOver on a daily basis. I'll occasionally use it. What I actually like to do is have long articles and stuff read to me. So sometimes I'll have VoiceOver do it, or sometimes I'll get it onto my iOS devices. I'm a big iOS user. I got my first iPhone when accessibility features VoiceOver first came to the phone. I was miserable when the iPhone came out and there was no accessibility. I borrowed one from somebody and realized it just wasn't going to work for me to have access to it. So I spent about a year being really unhappy. And then Apple put VoiceOver and the other accessibility features into iOS. And I find not only do I use iOS as a mobile platform, but there are ways in a writing world where I use it instead of the Mac. I write on the iPad. I listen to a lot of books that are read on the iPad. I consume a lot of information via audio, and I'm becoming more and more dependent on and fond of iOS as a main platform, even though I still have the Mac in front of me.
I think that's kind of a trend, as Steve Jobs used to say, the post-PC era. I know that I, too, am relying more on my iPhone for basically all of the little things that I used to do on my Mac, banking and some writing tasks and a lot of reading. I really don't read on the computer anymore.
I don't like being tethered to the computer to read. I'm one of those that's really upset that they've killed Google Reader, because I get up in the morning and my routine is to sit and read through a bunch of RSS feeds. But what I do now is, if there's an article that I really want to read, I use Readability. Readability and Instapaper are great services, both for this purpose. But you see an article that you like, you use a bookmarklet on your browser to send it to the Readability app, which then you can call up on your iPhone or iPad, and you can either read visually or use VoiceOver to have the article read to you. And I don't want to sit at my computer and do that.
No,
I want to go
no.
in the other room. I want to,
yeah.
If I'm cooking or walking or whatever it is. And I think part of it for me was that I was such an early adopter of podcasting, both as a creator and a listener. And so now I want everything in my ears. I think I'm a little bit of a lazy reader sometimes, because I could read visually and I have, you know, high contrast and reverse video, and there's some nice tools for that. But I find my default tends to be audio.
Mine too. You know, I have a Braille display and I love it for certain things, but for reading things like books, I do tend to default more to VoiceOver, especially now, you know, with the higher quality voices that are available. It's just more pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have so many choices that we didn't have even 5-10 years ago, for sure, with all of the, not only the audio materials that are available, but all the electronic materials that are available in various formats, that VoiceOver can read most of them. And it's such an interesting dilemma to be in. I was trying to, you know, work my way through the New York Times this morning and get a few things out of the way before doing the podcast, and it's like, wow, I just don't have time to read all this. And it's such an interesting problem to have, because when I was a kid, there was not enough material available to me, and I got sick of reading Westerns and you know, some of the religious materials that were available from my library. They didn't appeal to me, but it's all we had. And it's just interesting to realize now that how much that has changed, and we sort of have the opposite problem. There's now more out there than I can get through.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
I feel like we're on overload some days.
Oh, absolutely. And for me, it's just organizing it. It's like I was saying about Google Reader. I have RSS feeds in folders based on topic. So I know that the first thing I want to do in the morning is probably kind of get breaking news. So I'll get that from either NPR, or I'll listen to I'm an Audible member, and I get the New York Times Digest every morning, and so I listen to that. But then I'll go to Google Reader and I'll read news. I'll read my local news. I have a whole Austin folder. I have an accessibility folder. And I organize those things kind of based on my mood, what I feel like reading. The first thing in the morning, I don't really need to read about classic film, which is an interest of mine, but later in the day, I want to read that.
Right.
And organizing my life, and I mean, and my Audible backlog is just ridiculous. I can't even put all the books I have on my iPhone. And I just, you know, what am I going to read next? And
yeah.
I there's a lot of things languishing both in the Audible library and on my wish list, because I'll hear about some book that I must read, but then I realize, well, I don't have a credit, or I don't have time to read it right now. So I look at the wish list. It's like, when did I put that on there? I think that must have been 9 months ago or something.
I just joined a service called BookBub.com, BookBub.com, and it sends you a daily email with books that are on sale for that day, either from Amazon or Barnes & Noble or the iBook store. And a lot of times you can get a really good book for a dollar or so or
oh,
two.
Great.
And that's been a really fun resource to me, although I'm sure my wife is soon going to grow tired of seeing all these dollar, two, three credit card bills come come across.
I get into some real trouble with that.
Yeah.
My first reaction is, oh, I don't know how I would manage to read it, you know, not to mention all the little tiny transactions. I have a little bit of that with apps, but I'm always buying some dollar app that I desperately need, you know.
Yeah, it's very easy to spend those dollars, and they add up after a while, but it doesn't seem like a big deal at the moment. It's only a dollar.
And even if you don't like the app, you're like, oh, well, it's only a dollar. It's less than the cost of a soda, so what the heck, you know?
Sure.
You really have kind of been a pioneer in a way, not only for someone with low vision stepping out there and forging ahead in the technology, but also as being a woman. And I'm really curious, we once did a Tech Doctor podcast where we had several women on, and the discussion ended up being which has been more of an issue for you in technology, being female or being visually impaired. And I'm really curious if you have thoughts about that question.
That is a really interesting question, and I have to go back and listen to that podcast because it's a fascinating topic. I've run a couple of women in podcasting panels, and I've been to and talked to people in women in tech panels, and it's kind of an amorphous thing, because once you actually sit down to kind of try and process it, it's hard to know what to say that is going to be meaningful for somebody else. I mean, you can always tell stories, or you can, but it's something that I wrestle with, and I guess I'm going to have to say that for me, the low vision has been more of an issue, probably because it's something that's unfamiliar to other people, and also something that I myself have to work on a daily basis to figure out how to deal with. And yeah. I sometimes wonder if that might have covered up issues that I might have had from being female, simply because that was like the first thing. And once we got beyond that, since I was, you know, whether you want to call it overcompensating or whether you want to call it just trying my best to get along, that was more of an issue than being female. And I think some of the issue with being female is inside your own head. Not that there aren't things that go on, not that there isn't sexism out there, not that there isn't a lack of being taken seriously, but I do think that sometimes, and low vision too, but I do think that sometimes if you think about it too much and if you realize that you're in this environment with a whole bunch of dudes, it's easy to be inside your own head about it. And I was fortunate, I think, in two ways, because, as I said before, Mac User was an environment where there were a number of other women, and also where women were working in the department I was working in, and who took it upon themselves to focus on the accuracy and the quality of the content that we were producing. And so it was not as male-centric as some other in tech environments where it's really, really technical, whether it's engineering or programming, and that there was more of a female presence. And so I felt, and I worked for two women editors-in-chief while I was at MacUser, and I had a couple bosses that were women and a couple bosses that were men. And so that was fortunate. And as I've gone on in my career, I've worked with, when I was working with books, I tended to have female editors. So I guess the number of women in journalism kind of insulated me from some of the male-dominated nature of the tech world. Although, as I said, I mean, one of the things I did was to try and make my portfolio a little more tech-heavy than writing-heavy, and part of that was about low vision, but part of that was about, yeah, we women can do this too, you know. And it was my interest. I realized that there are plenty of people who are great on the sort of copy editing, proofreading, fact-checking side. But that what I was actually really interested in writing about those accelerators, and I took my portfolio as networking. I wrote a lot about remote access servers back when that was a thing, and I did the first review at MacUser of the AUX box that they created and all that stuff. And part of that I did to kind of make a distinct place for myself, and part of it I did because it was actually an interest of mine.
It was important for you to establish that geek cred.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you really needed to do that to feel like you were on equal footing, it sounds like. And you've even used the term you said a while ago that you learned to lean into it, you know, and
I know that was a total accident. That was like, how come I said that?
Yeah, and you know, with the Sheryl Sandberg book out now, which, you know, it's kind of interesting that you just accidentally said that, but But it sounds like you, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if you couldn't relate to a lot of things that she talks about in that book. It's a very interesting book.
I haven't read it, and I know it's controversial, and I don't honestly know whether I will read it. I think that from what I understand, some of the controversy is justified in the sense that she comes from a particular perspective, and she's fairly high level, and I'm not, was never at that point. I never reached like an upper management position and all that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting, and I'm sort of 50-50 about whether I'm actually going to read it.
But, well, I'm just glad she's bringing the issues to the forefront.
Yeah, it's a good topic to talk about, exactly.
I know that there are many things going on right now in your life, and we heard from your recent visit to CSUN that you are currently in the process of working on a new book about accessibility. Will you tell us a little bit about it?
I'm working on a book called iOS Access for All, Your Comprehensive Guide to Accessibility Features in iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch. And basically, it is a how-to guide for anybody who wants and needs accessibility features, whatever your disability. People always have, first thing people ask me is this a voiceover book? And I say, yes, and it's more. Because, as you know, there are features for low vision folks, there are features to help hearing impaired folks, there are features to help people with cognitive or motor issues. So there are any number of accessibility related features that Apple has included in iOS, and I want to cover all of those. And I also want to cover features that are part of iOS that will help with accessibility even though they're not necessarily labeled as such. So, for example, I was working on the low vision chapter this weekend, and I was talking about how you can use the ability to create your own wallpaper to create the kind of a contrast environment that is most easy for you to work in on iOS. So I want to include a lot of tips and tricks like that. And then there's also a section about great apps from an accessibility point of view. So apps that are intended to enhance accessibility and also apps that just happen to be accessible that people will find useful. And so it's going to be this, it's a little like the technology magazines I've worked for in the sense that it's part how-to and part product review or at least product roundup. And so I'm in the midst of writing that. At the moment, it's going to be a self-published book. I say that because I'm talking to a publisher, but I'm not sure what's going to happen. But I really want to make this the kind of book where it's going to be that it will continue to live so that the minute that I publish it, it won't go out of date. So I'm going to provide updates, and I also want to give people the opportunity to contribute their feedback and their tips and tricks. And I haven't worked out all of that, but the idea is this is going to be a book that anybody in the accessibility community, whether they're a beginner, whether they're an experienced user, will get some value from, and will be able to do a comprehensive job of covering all the accessibility features and not just the sort of 800-pound gorilla, which is a voiceover.
Well, first, it sounds like an extraordinary book, and I'm really glad you're doing it. We need something like this.
We really do.
Secondly, though, it seems like an awful lot to bite off when you think about the enormous task of covering virtually all aspects of accessibility. I can't imagine what must be going into that. Sounds like you have your work ahead of you.
What I love about your statement there is that the reaction from the mainstream folks that I've talked to, and I know a lot of people, as you can imagine, in the sort of Mac press, and I went to Macworld earlier this last month and talked to them, and their reaction is the complete opposite. They don't say it out loud, but what they're thinking, based on their questions, is, what is there to say about accessibility? You just turn it on and it works. And so part of my task is to flush out the fullness of accessibility and also the fact that just like with any technology that people use, accessibility comes with its own set of tips and tricks and challenges and workarounds. All that stuff that people take for granted in a mainstream Mac environment or Windows environment, but that they don't really understand exist in accessibility. So it's a big task, but there is a kind of a disconnect between the way the mainstream world understands it and the way those of us who use accessibility do, which is one of the things that I found most fascinating as I've been talking to people about the book.
You're probably familiar with Allison Sheridan of the NosillaCast.
Yeah, actually, we had lunch out there at Macworld, at CSUN. She was out there as well. So.
And she did some really interesting things last year where she did a couple presentations blindfolded, and she probably told you about them. but it really forced her to dig into the nuances of voiceover accessibility, because she had to actually do some tasks while she was blindfolded in front of a crowd. And I think it's certainly one of the things that highlighted was the whole accessibility issues are much more complex and much more subtle to really make them work than a person looking over your shoulder and saying, oh, that's cool, that thing talks to you like that, would ever realize. And it seems like that's what you've got to try to capture in this book somehow.
Well, it's actually interesting you say that, because I talked to Allison about that presentation, and she said there was a point at which she had some issues with making some stuff work in that presentation, and as often happens with a tech presentation, something just didn't go right.
Right.
And there were a bunch of us at the table talking, and the discussion was whether that sort of crash she had, those issues, was a good thing to have happened in a presentation. In one way, it makes accessibility just like any other technology, where you can have maybe it isn't perfect. Either the features aren't complete, feature set isn't complete, or the functionality is such that you could get into a bind. But the other side of this discussion was, does that humanize accessibility for people who are in the mainstream world? In other words, are we showing our dirty laundry because accessibility doesn't always work the way we want to? And we didn't really come to a resolution on that topic, but it's really interesting. You know, do you make accessibility seem perfect for folks, or do you say, well, warts and all? Are we saying to Apple, here are the things that we'd like you to do better, or are we simply saying, you know, accessibility, like anything else, has flaws and limitations?
Well, I think showing the warts in that presentation certainly connected her more with her audience. She was on the Tech Doctor podcast, and we talked about that in some detail. And, you know, she really was able to allow people to see her sweat, in a sense, which made it very, very real.
Yeah, and I also think, and I didn't see the presentation, and I talked to her about it because I wanted to know whether she thought Macworld would be open to additional accessibility presentations. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe myself down the road or some other folks. But I think that one thing about Allison is, if anybody was going to do a presentation about accessibility to mainstream audience, Allison is probably one of the best people I can think of, because she really handles the sort of uh-oh moments really well, and also in a really human way.
Yeah.
And so I think that was probably to her advantage. Whatever you think about the ultimate result of the warts and all approach to accessibility, I'm glad it was she that was up there rather than me.
Yeah, right.
I might not handle it as well as she did.
Exactly. So I gather from what you're saying that this book is going to be very comprehensive and kept up to date. You must plan to have some sort of web interactivity or some way to update the book once it comes out?
Yes, and what I'm promising people who buy the book is that they will have updates whenever iOS or whenever something significant happens in accessibility that affects iOS comes, that's not a huge... I want to do all the dot updates for free. I'm not going to charge again for the book, but I will have dot updates. And so if Apple comes out with iOS 6.1.4.7, you're not going to be charged for that update. Now, when we get to iOS 8, perhaps there will be. But I want to be really open and honest with people and say, you will get updates. This is a project that I'm, you know, back in the day when we were doing paper books, you would produce a book and you might go on a couple podcasts or get into some forums, but then the book would sort of be dead and you'd wait for the next book to come out. I mean, I did 5 versions of the Adobe Go Life book, but this book is going to have to be a living, breathing thing, and especially since there's such a component of app accessibility in there with all the different apps that, you know, people come out with. I've learned about 5 or 6 apps at CSUN that are not out and probably will not be out when the book comes out that I want to include in future versions, and I've made those kinds of notes. And so what I'm saying to people is, you know, you jump on the bandwagon with me now in 6 months when the best GPS app in the universe is out,
right?
Or when Apple adds, I don't know, something that we can't even anticipate to VoiceOver, that you can go along with me, and so there will be a mechanism for updates. And I'm probably also going to do blogs and podcasts just to keep people updated. So when issues come up that don't necessarily require an update to the book, at least I can get on and say, hey, let's talk about this in blog or podcast form. And the thing I'm working on right now is figuring out how to let people be a part of it, do a more interactive way. I mean, obviously there's blog comments and feedback from podcasts and stuff, but I'm I'm working to figure out a way to let people become involved, because everybody has a tip, you know, everybody has some workaround right. that they have or a favorite app. And I want to crowdsource that. That's, you know, the hip term, right? But I want to do it because I don't know everything. And I'm not a daily voiceover user. And I can anticipate people who are saying, well, low vision girl, what do you know about how to do the intricacies of voiceover? Right. And all I can say is, well, I'm a meticulous product reviewer. I've been doing that for 20 years. But you might know more about how to use that particular rotor function than I do. And I want to hear about that. And I want to include that in the book in a way that's fair to both of us so that that information can get out in the community, but it doesn't look like I knew everything. I got some help putting it together. So I'm still working on how that should happen, but I'm really interested in having people's feedback about it. And anybody who has any thing to offer about the book or any ideas, you know, feel free to write me. We can do contact info at the end or however you want to do it, but I'd love to hear from people.
Excellent. And you're just an ideal person to do that with your background, your experience, and with that, just that idea of sort of crowdsourcing and pulling information together that way. I'm really excited about it. It sounds like it's going to be great. And I'm looking forward to seeing how people do indeed contribute, because I bet you'll get a lot of contributions.
Oh, yeah.
I hope so. And I know that there are a lot of sources of information out there about iOS. There are lots of communities out there, and I try and keep tabs on those as best I can. And the thing I find about that stuff is that it's really amorphous. Unless you're on top of it constantly, you don't know what people are saying or what the best app is or what. And so what I want to do is find a way, not necessarily, I don't want to create a new community, but I want to create a way so that whatever the best of the wisdom of the accessibility community is, that somebody can go to the site or open the book and kind of see that in as close to real time as is practical. Essentially, I become somebody who takes all of this huge flow of information, we were talking about information overload, and finds sort of the best bits and says, I know there's 20 GPS apps. Let me give you some suggestions about what I think are the four or five best with different functions. But here are the kinds, here's the crowdsourced wisdom about what those apps will and won't do for you. So,
and that's one of the things that really excites me about this book, because of course, as a user of any particular accessibility solution on iOS devices, we tend to get, because there's so much information available now, we tend to get kind of pigeonholed in our own solution, whether it be assistive touch or voiceover or Zoom, because there's just so much out there. So I think this is going to be a great way, especially for people who are trainers or rehab professionals like myself, to be able to disseminate some of that other information about the other solutions now to our consumers. So that's awesome.
I'm a pretty down-to-earth, plain-spoken kind of person. I know there's this concept of plain language, but I believe in that in terms of accessibility. And I think a lot of times what gets written about accessibility is hidebound in terms of, you know, I don't want to offend, but it's sort of bureaucrat speak or rehab speak or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know rehab speak because I've never been in that business. So
I barely know rehab speak.
but you know it exists, right? I mean, yes. You know that there's a way of speaking out there.
Yeah.
That it's professionals talking to professionals, but doesn't necessarily address the needs of end users in a way that they can understand. And what I hope is that this will be an end user book that a rehab professional can pick up and either recommend to their consumers, or that they'll get in a very plain spoken way the information that they need. Because I can't do anything else. I can't write in rehab speak. It would just hurt my heart, and I wouldn't be able to do it.
Well, it would hurt my heart to read it. So.
You know, I personally think the next frontier in a lot of ways for accessibility is to get into the mainstream world with it, and to help people in the mainstream world understand it more, because it shouldn't be such a jaw-dropping thing when I approach, for example, a particular mainstream Mac podcaster, and I say let's do a show on accessibility, and they're like horrified, because the reality of it is, even though I don't use the screen on my Mac, most of what I do on my Mac I do in a very similar manner and use most of the same tools that they're podcasting about, having no idea that a blind person does these things, but we need to somehow make it more, quote, normal, or make it more, more widely understood, because that way we can all work together better, I think.
Well, now you're getting into a topic that is pretty near and dear to me and that I get a little bit riled up about, because spending so much time in the mainstream world, I used accessibility for myself, but I didn't write a great deal about it. I did a Macworld feature about it some time ago and was completely surprised when they asked me to do it. But I've never really been able to get mainstream publications or podcasts, which is now much more important than it used to be, interested in talking about accessibility, except in terms of it being a curiosity. I've been on a couple of podcasts, and a couple of other people have been successful in making connections with some podcasters, and they are occasionally invited on. But it's been really, really incredibly difficult, even after iOS, even after the Mac and iOS were both so successful with VoiceOver. It's been incredibly difficult to get product reviews that have to do with accessibility stuff, or even when, for example, iTunes became more accessible, you didn't read very much about that when it happened. It wasn't something that people were aware of. And I always felt, gosh, you know, I have these connections, and I've tried to drop hints in people's ears, and Twitter is great for that, by the way, and just say, hey, you realize that there's been a significant enhancement in accessibility. Let's talk about that. Even if you don't hire me to write it, which is not why I was mentioning it to people, you know, it's something to cover, and I'd be happy to be a resource for you. And the other side of that is not getting pigeonholed in terms of accessibility. I think one of the reasons that I stayed in the mainstream so long, even though I was trying to talk about accessibility, was that I didn't want to get pigeonholed as the accessibility person. I would rather be known as the networking person or the web development person or whatever it was. So it's only in the past few years that I've kind of come out about accessibility, and now, having done that, I sort of look back and I go, hey, why aren't you guys more interested in it? And one thing that I really like to sit down with some of these folks and do is just have a heart-to-heart with them and say, look, I'm not trying to confront you. I just want to understand, from your points of view as a journalist, why is it that accessibility is not something that gets covered more? And maybe to put it more positively, what do you need to know about accessibility in order to make it something that's of value to cover in the mainstream world? And so I still have this sort of dream of being a bridge between those worlds, and I don't know, maybe it'll happen, maybe not, but maybe this book will help in that way. I don't know.
I think there's a good possibility that this book very well might help in that way, and we all need to be thinking in that direction, I think, because it's been a niche too long, and it needs to come out more into the mainstream. We would all benefit from that, not just people with disabilities, but mainstream folks as well. I mean, it's just a shame that you can sort of mention accessibility and it's almost like you feel the temperature drop in the room, and it shouldn't be that way.
No.
Yeah, and I think there's one more benefit too, is that there is a sort of a satisfaction that mainstream folks get when they know that iOS or the Mac is accessible, or any platform is accessible, because they feel like now they don't have to worry about that anymore. And they also get this sort of warm feeling. The idea that autistic kids are using the iPads in school, that's great, or blind kids or whoever, that's great. But they're not really thinking about how they're using those or what actual benefit they're getting. They just want to know that it's happening. It's like an Apple commercial. That's the level of detail that some people want to address accessibility to, that if the Apple commercials say that there's a GPS out there that lets a blind person hike in the woods, or an app out there that allows an autistic kid to communicate in a way that they couldn't on the iPad, that's kind of the, and then the word inspiring always gets used, which is one of my least favorite words.
Yeah.
but that once you've gone that far, then that's all we really want to know, that they really want to know. And a lot of people, it's not, you know, it's a benign neglect, I guess, is one way of putting it. It's not malicious or anything. It's just that it's not a level of detail they want to go. And like I say, I think the more things out there that have accessibility implications, whether they be apps or whether they be applications on the Mac, I think there need to be more product reviews. For example, if you're doing a GPS app, it may be a mainstream GPS app, but let's talk about how it works for folks who use it walking and not just hiking in the woods, but actually navigating. Now, that's usually a pretty good argument to make to people who live in San Francisco, which is a walking city.
Right.
But, you know, we haven't talked in reviews of Apple Maps about whether whether voice functions work when you're walking as opposed to when you're driving. I mean, that's just a sort of a detail level kind of thing. But it's an issue. It's a pet peeve of mine.
Well, it's an important issue, and it's not just an issue that's outside of the disabled community either. We have, I did my PhD dissertation in 1989 on this very topic, but I was looking at to what extent do rehabilitation professionals elaborate on the technology that they choose for their clients. Do they really know the technology, or do they choose like they choose their toothpaste because it's in a bright blue tube and it catches their eye because the manufacturer did the best job of advertising, or not really because they know and understand what the technology is all about? And I found clearly, was able to clearly demonstrate that was exactly true, that even rehab professionals don't know. In the mainstream, there are, of course, exceptions, but a lot of them don't know the technology well enough to really be making meaningful recommendations for their clients. So it's a huge issue, and, you know, some 25 years later, we still need to tackle it somehow.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, my focus is always product review and evaluation, and I'm real value-oriented. So I always want to be really honest and straightforward about the differences between tools and helping people decide. I have a real passion for that. And one tool, and I think with accessibility, people get blinders on, forgive the pun, that say, oh, it's accessible. That must make it really cool. Well, maybe the app works really well and maybe it doesn't, right, either in an accessibility context or in a general context.
Yeah. The devil can be in the details sometimes.
Indeed.
Well, I think this has really been turned out to be an interesting discussion, and I appreciate these points that have been raised. And I guess I was wondering, just as we kind of begin to draw to a close here, what's the time frame on the book? When do you expect it to be out, and how can people find out more about it?
Well, the book is called iOS Access for All, and you can find out more about it at iosaccessbook.com. And right now, that's just a WordPress blog with some FAQs about the book. And also, if you go to the bottom of the screen there, you can add your email address to a mailing list, and I'm going to be providing information as I get closer to publication just to let people know what's going on with the book. There's also an email address there where you can send feedback to me separately. That's iosaccessbook.com, and look for that site to grow and change as we get closer to publication. And that publication date isn't set in stone, but I am shooting for late spring, early summer, and that is to some extent dependent on whether I end up with a publisher or whether I continue along the brave new world of self-publishing. But I'm definitely shooting for no later than early summer.
Do you anticipate it being available in places like the iBook store or on other electronic devices, or do you know about that yet?
I think I'm going to do as many formats as the market demands. And again, that's something I can use some feedback on, because I want to do accessible PDF at minimum, which is about the most portable thing there is out there, and also makes sense to be in the iBook store. Somebody asked me whether it's going to be on Kindle, and I doubt very seriously, given Kindle's limitations in terms of speech accessibility and stuff like that. So I don't really see a great deal of point in that. Besides, there's some restrictive issues. I've learned a lot about e-publishing business in the course of this book, and so right now what I'm telling people is accessible PDF, iBook store, and if there are other formats that seem really compelling to people, I'd be happy to hear about it, keeping in mind that this is a how-to book with some illustrations, screenshots, and that sort of thing. And so I want to make it as accessible and widely available as possible, but I also want to keep the number of formats focused and, you know, give the maximum accessibility without spending a whole lot of time translating into tons of different formats. But I would happily accept any feedback on formats that people think are important.
Well, great. I'm hoping you'll get some as a result of being on the podcast here. And perhaps it would make sense to, if you're willing to do it, have you back around once the book is out, and we can maybe talk more at that point about kind of how it's evolved and where it's headed and so forth.
I love that. The virtual book tours. Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah, exactly, because I just have a feeling that it's going to be happening fast and furious when it comes out, that there are likely to be very interesting things developing around it in terms of the feedback that you get and so forth.
Hope so. And I've really enjoyed talking to you guys. And every time I talk to somebody new about this book and I get new questions, I get more that I can take back to my little, process that I'm writing here in my little office. And so the more people I can talk to, it can't help but improve the quality of what I end up publishing.
We have really enjoyed talking with you too. And I just have one more question for you that really isn't related to the book or anything, but it is definitely tech related. As someone who had the length of career that you've had in tech, and particularly as a woman, what advice would you give to particularly a woman in technology who may want to break into it as a career, or to even switch careers and focus more on technology?
I guess I'd say first start by knowing what you want, and then educating yourself toward that. So if you want to be in technology, but you're not a programmer, focus on something like web development or like writing or whatever it is that you're really interested in. Find a way to laser focus in on that. And you can always broaden out later, but get a start and and that will also help. Not only will you learn, but you'll also become much more confident. And I think the key, especially as a woman in technology, really is that confidence of being able to go into a room, whether it's full of guys or just full of people who are more experienced than you, and be confident in what you know. If I went into a room of C programmers, I wouldn't be very confident because I'm not a C programmer. But I know all about the Mac, I know all about iOS, and I'm completely comfortable in that world. So I would say that would be a start. And then because your own self-confidence and then acquiring mentors after that are probably going to be the two, whether they're formal or informal. I mean, even if you don't go up to somebody and say, be my mentor, finding somebody to emulate and to ask their advice is probably, my big mentor in technology happened to be a guy, but he was really cool. He didn't have any issues with women in technology, and I learned a great deal from him in terms of just like how to kind of be in the world. And so I guess those would be two pieces of advice I'd give.
Excellent, thank you.
Well, Shelley, you gave contact information about the book. Any other contact information you want to provide people, or do you want them just to reach you through the book website?
Well, my main website is brisbin.net, BRISBIN.net, and I blog there, and I also have information about all the work that I do, articles I've written, books I've written. Everything about Shelley starts at brisbin.net. Shelley'spodcast.com is the podcast site. You can find all the podcasts on brisbin.net too, and App Store Pundit. So I would just say go to brisbin.net, dig around, click on the podcast link, and click on the bio link if you want to learn who I am and what I'm about. And then the book is iosaccessbook.com.
Well, great. And thank you again so much for taking time to be with us today. And until next time, I'll say so long from the Tech Doctor.
Bye, Robert. Bye, Shelley. Thank you.
Thank you all.